It's time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cyclists, trails, travel, advocacy, the bike industry, and much, much more. You can subscribe to our weekly podcast at OutspokenCyclist.com or through your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for August 14th, 2021. What a week! So much rain, humidity, and heat, but today dawned lovely, and I'm excited to bring you this week's show. If you're like me, the thought of racing a mountain bike for 100 miles, starting at 10,000 feet, climbing 12,500 more feet in a day is utterly terrifying. And yet, my first guest has done it 23 times, finishing it 22 times, and is about to go again. Today, actually, August 14th. Eldon Nelson is, by all rights, the Leadville 100 guru. He even has a podcast dedicated to the event. But last year, COVID put the kibosh on the race, and a series of small snafus have resulted in too many participants for this year. Yet still, the race will go on, and I wanted to catch up with Eldon to get the lowdown on this year's event. Then, after a break, we finally get to speak with Strongtown's Chuck Marone about his upcoming book, Confessions of a Recovering Engineer. Chuck's perspective on planning and what will keep towns and cities solvent, even prosperous, have come up against an establishment that is both defensive and unyielding to new ways of thinking about roads, bridges, and how we live today. That establishment still relies on 50-year-old ideas and technology in a world where new options abound. So what brings someone back to this Leadville 100 event year after year? Maybe it's the nifty belt buckle, and you can see a photo of Eldon's on our website, OutspokenCyclist.com. But I think it's a lot more than that. Hi, Eldon. Welcome back to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me today. Look at you, all those medals behind you. You're looking pretty spiffy.
I got my 20-year Leadville buckle here as well, if you'd like to see it. It's too bad it's
not a video. I would, and I want you to send me a picture of it for the website. That would be so awesome. Awesome. So, wow, Leadville. We were talking right before we went into recording that it's going to be a hassle to get there this year. What's going on?
Oh, well, all of the fires in Colorado last year made it so that the rain this year is causing massive erosion on I-70. And so Glenwood Canyon is just buried under mud. Those of us who normally would be using I-70 between Glenwood Springs and I'm not exactly sure how far the problem is, but it means that I will not be able to go that way to get to Leadville. Like most people who are coming from the Western US, I am going to need to go via Steamboat Springs. So an extra 2 to 3 hours of driving this year.
Well, that kind of sucks.
Maybe a lot of people think so, but I love audiobooks, so I'm kind of looking forward to it.
Okay, so then you get a little extra audiobook time, but will you arrive as fresh? Oh, you're going to be there a day ahead at least, right?
I will be there a week ahead. I got lots of relaxed time. That's one of the pro tips for Leadville. Get there a week early if you can so that you can enjoy the place instead of race the place and also get used to being at 10,000 feet altitude. It's nice to grow a few new red blood cells.
I think it would take me a lot longer than a week. I just don't do well at that altitude, but I guess eventually you acclimate, yeah?
Eventually you do. Yeah. Eventually you get used to it. But a lot of folks who are building new houses in that area are building pressurized bedrooms now. I am not making this up.
How could you? It's just too bizarre to make up. I love it.
A little extra oxygen when you sleep.
There you go. So let's talk about Leadville. A lot of changes. Mm-hmm. Lifetime Fitness announced this past week they bought Sea Otter Classic.
Yeah.
They're just on a tear along with outside. They're on a tear on another part of it. They're getting all the publications. Lifetime's getting all the events. So I'm wondering, what are some of the changes? And, you know, you're the Leadville guru. Tell me what's going on.
Yeah. So, I mean, last year, of course, there was no Leadville 100. There really weren't many races at all. And that actually, so there were a lot of deferrals. And Lifetime was very, very good about taking your entries, which are very expensive, from 2020 and letting you apply them either to 2021 or to 2022. But that was compounded onto a huge snafu that they had made when it was registration time, where instead of giving the normal one out of, you know, every five or six people an entry into Leadville, they let everyone in. And so they had already been encouraging people to defer. And then with the COVID thing, it was a real mess. The short version of this is 2021 has more than hit its limit. 2022 will also more than hit its limit. If you want to get into Leadville, start thinking about 2023 would be my advice. Straight up, that's the way it is. So that is one thing.
What is the limit? What should the limit be?
Boy, that actually leads into the next question. The number of people that are allowed onto certain parts of the land is capped.
Okay.
And I think it's capped higher than the number that they let on. I think 1,800 people is how many people they let on the course every year. And that has been a problem for the last several years, simply because of the start. The start is a fast downhill on pavement. Then it suddenly you hit dirt and you are climbing at a very steep, 1 mile, and everything bottlenecks. And the back half of the race basically has to get off their bike and walk for a while. That was not a great experience for anyone who was not not up in the first half of the field. This year, they are experimenting with something that's been done in other races, and that is wave starts. And this is new, and it's something I've actually advocated publicly for a number of years. So if it works, I get to claim credit. If it doesn't work, then we'll just forget that we ever had this conversation.
How will they run their waves? Are they looking at age group? Are they looking at men, women? What are they looking at?
By previous time.
Oh, okay.
Or by qualifier time. So there is a gold and silver corral where you've got mostly pros and neo pros, people who can turn in a very, very fast time. Then there is folks who are, you know, more citizen, but still very fast. And it works all the way back to what is called the white corral, which is people who have not raced in another lifetime event race or haven't done so recently and don't have a finishing time in a previous Leadville 100. In other words, people who are untested as far as the race series is concerned, and so are starting at the very back. However, there is they're doing increasing length waves. So there's 2 minutes between, then 3 minutes between, then 4 minutes, and it works like that. So things should hopefully be a little more spread out than they have been in the past. I'm very hopeful that it's going to be a real big improvement, but it does affect the course in other ways.
Let me take a moment to reintroduce you. We're speaking with Eldon Nelson. He is Mr. Leadville. How many Leadvilles have you done?
I have started in 23 and have finished 22. Hopefully I will be finishing my 23rd later this month.
Yeah, later this month is right. So other than this new way of doing Leadville this year, partly because of the snafu from the registration system, what has Lifetime brought to the event?
I would say they brought a lot of awareness of this kind of race. They've created sort of an ecosystem. I would say that they've also brought the qualifier system, I think, is pretty dang cool. And the fame of their marquee events, Leadville 100, Unbound, has made it so that some of the satellite races have a chance to become better known, like Crusher and the Tusher, which is close to home. It is always sold out, but now it is part of the same race series that has brought you the Leadville 100. And I think that that brings a chance for some really big, some big awareness and perhaps more racers. Apart from that, if you were to ask me on race day, what does a lifetime bring me? I'd be hard pressed to say what. I mean, back in, 20 plus years ago when Ken Klober was doing this race just by himself and, a few friends, I had a fantastic time. Is my time markedly better this, last year, well, 2 years ago when Lifetime put it on? It would be hard for me to say yes. They're a good race promoter, but I mean, they've made some pretty colossal mistakes in recent times that they need to learn from if they're going to retain credibility in the race community.
Give me an example of one of those.
Well, I would say the registration snafu was
okay. That's a big one.
I also, in my podcast last year, I criticized them pretty heavily, along with my co-host Michael Houghton. They were very late to the table in saying we are not going to do the race this year. They waited way too long. Ah. Their communication doesn't come very often, and they don't let racers know as much as they want to know, forcing, podcasts like mine, which I guess is good for us, to do a little bit of digging for information that should be available by default.
Yeah, it seems to me all you should be able to do is call up the race on the internet and it's all there. I mean, it's not a difficult task to lay out the rules. That's, of course, my opinion and your opinion at this point.
I do want to say that, one of the other changes that happened this year, and I don't know what is going on behind the scenes there, but pretty late in the year, maybe month and a half, 2 months before the Leadville 100, the race director left the company and went to Ironman. Huh. And so there is now an interim race director, Melly, which in my personal opinion is fantastic news for Lifetime and for all the racers of Leadville 100. I've had such transparent access with someone who is very much a race in his own right. So he understands races. So, I for sure don't want this to seem like I'm just picking on Lifetime. In my opinion, Lifetime via Mike Melly, who is just an interim race director, he's usually VP of operations, I think, in the Leadville Race Series, is a fantastic, transparent, really, really accessible person who is doing a lot of work to make this race better.
Well, that's a good thing. We like races that get better.
So for sure.
You also told me before when we were preparing for our conversation today that the routes have changed. What's changed with the routes?
So it's a little bit of a ripple effect on the wave start that I was talking about. So there are places where normally you can have, since it's a nearly pure out and back course, where there are places where there would be a choke point where the race leaders would be coming back in a place where some, the tail end of the field might be going out and having congestion. They've needed to do a few workarounds to all but those of us who live for this race would probably find not especially important, but there are a couple that are interesting. Because they've had to move things around and make it a little bit longer in some points, the turnaround point is a little bit sooner, which means that folks like me can look forward to being at 12,500 feet for a mile and a half less during the race. And I'm super happy about that.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah.
So what would you say to somebody who has never raced Leadville? Maybe they've done Unbound. Or maybe they went down to Bentonville and did some mountain biking and racing down there. But what is it about Leadville that is so compelling that somebody would do it 23 times?
I think it is the fact that there is no air. That is a big part of it. The same course, if it were transported to California, would not be compelling. It would be a pretty ordinary 100-mile mountain bike race. The fact that it is so difficult in such a different way makes it really interesting. Plus, there is the combination of the small town vibe and the huge energy from a very big mountain bike race, so that you, I mean, these two forces almost conflict. You have so many crews, so many racers, and in such a small town, it feels almost surreal, Diane. It is just amazing to have the Tour de France tunnel of people treatment when you are in a tiny town at 10,000 feet in Colorado.
It sounds really cool. It kind of, what you're describing reminds me of rolling into one of the little ragbri towns in Iowa, you know, and the whole town turns out and they put on the little hoses with the water trickling down to cool you off and that kind of thing. It brings an energy to the, to a town that probably has never seen it before, unless they've done ragbri in the past. I had another question about the equipment. What has changed in your equipment personally since you did the first race 23 years ago?
Everything. So I remember this is 1997 and Ibis had just released the bow tie, a full suspension bike that used the frame as its suspension, essentially a leaf spring suspension. It was the single coolest thing in the planet. And I got in line and managed to get mine a week before the race. It's 26 inch titanium frame base. Full suspension bike. I mean, versus today, I'm riding a 29-inch carbon hardtail that weighs probably 9 pounds less. I mean, it's my mountain bike. I weighed it obsessively. It weighs 18 and a half pounds.
He's the weight weenie.
I am.
Yeah, well, whatever.
I'm a nerd in so many ways.
We're in the bike world. Of course we're nerds.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Well, so along with the difference in frame, it's interesting you're riding a hardtail. This course, it doesn't matter if you've got suspension or not. Why are you finding it that, okay, you went from suspension to a hardtail?
It's an internal argument, and you would find this conversation happening in many forums about Leadville all over the place. But it is a course that you can get some advantages from the suspension, but you also get some advantages because of all of the climbing from a hardtail. Weight matters when you are at that altitude and doing 12,500 feet of climbing in a day. Anything that you don't have to carry up the mountain is nice to not carry up the mountain. There are only, I would say, probably 15 miles that full suspension is markedly better than hardtail. And there are many, many more miles where hardtail is a little bit faster. And I am a standing climber. And so hardtail really feels great to me. I use a super wide bar. I've ridden a single speed for a lot of my cycling lifetime. And hardtail just feels right to me. It's personal.
So what is the component package on the bike?
Oh, so now we're going to get into sponsored territory. This is awesome.
Oh, well, you know, I'm the tech weenie when it comes to that stuff.
Fantastic. So Shimano is one of my podcast sponsors. And so I am full Shimano XTR as far as components and brakes. I am also sponsored by Envy, where my podcast is. And so Envy 525 wheels. I use an M6 bar because it is as wide as I am tall, practically, and it allows me to stand and row. I love it. All of this is built on a specialized Epic Hardtail S-Works frame. And I mean, when you do all the math, you come up with a very light bike. Front suspension is a Sid Ultimate Seal.
Okay, then. What about pedals and shoes?
Pedals are both Shimano. So thank you for asking.
Of course.
The pedals are XTR SPDs, yeah. And my shoes are S-Fire X9. I have very wide feet, and Shimano has wide foot sizing for their shoes, which means the difference between having a fun day on any given bike ride and having a really painful day on a bike ride.
Right. Used to be the only wide shoes were Carnex and CD Megas.
Yep.
So I had a question about you being able to get components and other people not. Are you drinking beer?
Fresca.
Oh, I was all excited. I had wine before, but dinner's over. Okay, go ahead.
How terrible. I'm drinking Fresca. I'm the least interesting person in the world.
No, I think it's interesting because I don't know anybody who drinks Fresca. That is interesting.
Fresca is my favorite drink.
There you go.
So anyway, I don't remember your question. I'm sorry.
It was about how you're getting components and bike shops aren't.
Oh, I'm not. I'm not getting components. It is.
I was kind of kidding, but.
Yeah, I wish I could. And you would think that I would have an inside track on them. But back when I bought this frame, it was, I think, April of 2020, and it was still possible to get frames and components. I bought everything at the same time, and wisely and luckily, I bought a lot of the consumable parts in two.
Chains, cassettes, that kind of thing.
I bought extra chains, bought extra tires I can still get. I think everyone can still get tires, but
yeah, some. Yeah. You're right.
Which ones, right? But I made a lucky choice, and I have a chain that I will sell to someone for $500.
But it has been a really, really strange and very difficult year. Well, so any closing thoughts?
How about this? How about if I tell you that you are doing the best shows you have ever done? I think I mentioned this to you on Facebook recently, and no one likes to get compliments, but I hope you're okay with this. I've been a fan of your show for, I don't know, how long have you been out?
It'll be 11 years next month.
Yeah, so I wasn't far off when I said a decade or more, but I think that you are asking such great questions, and I just love listening to your show. So thank you for continuing to do this for so long.
Wow. What a nice compliment from another podcaster. I really appreciate it. And, you know, it's interesting. Every once in a while, I'll get in a slump and I'll go, you know, maybe I've had enough. And then an event will come up. A conversation will come up. Somebody will say, you need to talk to so-and-so. And I'll tell you what's changed, and that's Zoom. Even though I have only done a few, and you don't see them, you and I can see each other, but I only use the audio, but it has changed the dynamic a little bit. And it's changed it, I think, in a positive way. It's like I do all my yoga classes by Zoom, and that's made me a better teacher. So apparently doing my podcast by Zoom might be making me a better host. I don't know.
Well, I mean, there's definitely sort of a democratization of access, right? It's easier because of Zoom and tools like this for you to get someone on a show, and there aren't all the logistical hurdles that there used to be.
Right.
So, yeah, it's you've always been great at finding great guests and asking great questions, and now it's perhaps a smaller hurdle for you to actually get them on the air.
And I appreciate all of the nice words. I wish you lots of luck. You and your wife, she's always racing with you.
I am. And this year, my daughter has gone pro, and she is going to be, I think, surprising a few people in the field. Look for Melissa Rollins. I'm going to say she's going to be on a podium in just a week and a half.
How cool is that? Well, thanks for taking time. I know it's late out there. It's late here. So have a great night. And we will talk again. Have a wonderful race. Stay safe.
Thank you, Diane.
All right. Eldon Nelson joined me from his home in Colorado. As of this podcast episode, he's in Leadville, probably somewhere up in the mountains for ride number 24. You can hear Eldon's podcast about Leadville at pod.link/Leadville. And I'm interested to hear how his daughter does, too. So let's take a break, and when we return, we'll welcome Chuck Marone back to the show. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
The Outspoken Cyclist is proud to have Bike Law as a trusted partner. If you find yourself in need of legal advice or assistance as it pertains to any cycling issue, log on to bikelaw.com. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Jenks. Whenever I have a conversation with Strong Town's Chuck Marone, I have the best of intentions to follow the train of thought I had planned out. Instead, I get a fascinating conversation that just flows from one topic to the next, and frankly, I'm happy with that. Hello, Chuck. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. I've been waiting for this opportunity. You told me about your new book.
Yes, you got a copy.
And now we get to actually talk about it. Let's catch up first. How is Strong Towns? I know you guys are just busier than heck.
Strong Towns is great. I mean, everything is going really well. We said that 2021 was going to be our year of action. You know, we had this kind of freeze in the pandemic and everybody struggled with how do we shift and how do we acclimate? But a lot of people came out of that with a desire to do stuff. And so we've spent the year really focusing on how do we get our kind of core Strong Towns activists the tools they need to be able to go out and do stuff. You know, the stuff we've written has focused on a lot of examples of people doing great things that people can copy, a lot of to-do lists and checklists and things like that. I've also spent a lot of my time this year working on something called the Strong Towns Academy, which is a series of courses that we've put together that are like the how-to guide for Strong Towns. So that's been a ton of fun and a different challenge. But you know, we've seen a lot of people even so far take this stuff and do amazing things with it.
So you're the principal at the school.
Yeah. Well, my building here is a former middle school, and I actually have the counselor's office. So I spent time in here as a student, and now I'm spending time in here as an adult, and it's quite nice. I like it a lot.
Sounds appropriate. Yeah. So I want to just go back to one thing that I knew was going on. There were people who were trying to take your engineering license away from you. And it has resulted in some legal proceedings. What's going on with that?
Yeah, I will talk about it. I really hate this topic and I hate having to spend my time consumed by it because it is petty and it never should have happened. So I'm a licensed engineer. And engineers have a licensing board authorized by the state to oversee their practice. I've had a number of complaints filed against me for things that I've written and things that I've said that are challenging of the engineering profession. Those complaints have largely been dismissed. The latest complaint, though, and it's like a petty little thing, but it's also very important. As part of being licensed, I had a period of time where my license lapsed. I don't do anything that requires a license. I don't sign any documents. Quite frankly, I'm really not good at paperwork. It's kind of why I'm a writer and not an engineer anymore. But I maintain my license because I earned it. I have it. And I pay my fee every other year and I do my continuing ed credits. I moved and I didn't get the update and I forgot to renew. I didn't update my bio. So I didn't change my bio when my license expired to say that I was no longer a licensed engineer. And some disgruntled engineer who doesn't like the things that I have written filed a complaint against me saying that I was claiming to be licensed when I wasn't. By the way, I found out that my license had expired before I received the complaint and I fixed it and everything. I never signed any documents. I never did anything that required a license. So, you know, really everything should be fine. The licensing board, however, has dug in And they've said, not only did I commit a crime, not only did I break the law, but I did so in a way that was intentionally dishonest, committed fraud against the citizens of Minnesota. I misrepresented myself. And they basically are trying to use the licensing process to slander me in a way that no licensed professional who speaks up should be subjected to. And so, yeah, there's a federal lawsuit right now that we have filed regarding free speech and the ability to, you know, for a licensed professional to be able to speak and not suffer retribution. And then there's a state lawsuit in administrative court that they have filed against me because I refused to sign the order that they have issued.
Wow. Talk about petty BS.
Yeah, it is. I don't want to make it too frivolous because you need to be licensed if you're practicing engineering.
I understand.
And I take that very seriously. I'm not practicing engineering. I didn't do anything that requires a license. I didn't realize my license had expired. And so I didn't update my bio, but that is a lot different than going out. The board deals with a lot of these cases where people claim to be engineers when they're not, but they are all cases where people who are not licensed go out and claim that they are. For me, I never went out and claimed that I was. I had my bio. I didn't like proactively write this bio knowing it was wrong. I had a bio. I've had a bio for 20 years. I didn't change it because I didn't know my license had expired. I agreed to pay a fine. I agreed to admit that my license had been expired in violation of state law. I admitted to all of that. What I won't sign an order is saying that I was intentionally misleading people, that I was dishonest, that I committed fraud. And it's been very disturbing to go through this process because it is clear from every interaction I've had with the board that they are interested in the words that I'm saying, the advocacy I'm doing, the things that we are sharing at Strong Towns and what our message is, not in what, you know, a license is or what I'm doing as a licensed professional.
Let me take a moment to reintroduce you. We're speaking with Chuck Marone. He is the founder of Strong Towns. It's strongtowns.org and is doing great work. I guess, where does it stand right now? Forget the federal one is the one I'm really most interested in.
Yeah, well, we filed the federal suit. And so our hope is that the federal court will intervene and basically tell the state to cease and desist. They have filed a motion to dismiss. That's going to be the first hearing in front of the judge. I anticipate that within the next 60 days. And so we will have that hearing. And if the judge denies that, then we'll actually have a court case. We'll actually take depositions and do all that. And I'm actually looking forward to that. I think that's an important part of this process.
Having been through something similar where a very wealthy customer tried to use the system to sue this little bike shop that I owned before he married this woman who he bought a bike for, and she went out and she tripped over a curb and fell and broke her face.
Jeez.
And then it was 3 years after she bought the bike and they tried to sue us for our original assembly.
Huh.
You know, it already had 500 miles on it. They had clearly done some terrible things to the bike, raising the stem up. And, you know, I mean, I had all my ducks in a row. It took the jury, but they insisted on going through a jury trial. It took them 8 minutes to find us not guilty. Wow. 8 minutes, of which six were to pick the jury foreman. But it was just interesting what people will go through thinking they're going to get something out of it. And
yeah,
I'm not sure what they want to get out of it for you other than to have you, you know, look bad.
Well, I've resisted trying to put myself in the minds of the board.
Okay.
I always like to assume the best intentions of people. I find it a healthy practice, but it's been very hard with this group because there's certainly, it's hard to find any way where they're interested in their role as a board and interested in, you know, the practice of engineering, because if they were, they would not have any interest with me at all. It is really hard not to see this as petty retribution that they are participating in. And I wish it would stop. I take no joy in any of this. And quite frankly, I feel like the person who filed this lawsuit is winning, because they filed the complaint. The person who made the complaint against me is winning. I called him and talked to him. I'm like, why, what's your point here? And he's, I read your stuff. I don't like it. I don't like you. And so he filed a complaint against me. And you know what? The complaint is meant to slander me, to make me look bad. And I think to tie me up, to tie up this organization and force us to spend time and resources fighting something that is frivolous. And you know what? That's what it's done. And it really bothers me, because I have spent an inordinate amount of time on this when it should go away.
Right.
I think the worst part is that I actually believe in that. There's a lot of people out there who think that we shouldn't have licensure and we shouldn't have accreditation, and these things are discriminatory and what have you. And I'm sympathetic to those arguments. The licensing process does shut out people, but an engineering license is something where I think as a society, you know, it's different than like a beautician's license or even like a planner certification, which is kind of an insider's club. An engineering license is something that we want people to have. I mean, if you're going to design a bridge, we want you to have the proper schooling, the proper training, the proper licensure. We want that as a society. And I believe in the licensing process. I think the end result of them abusing the process the way they are and abusing their standing is going to be a weakened licensure process.
That's too bad.
I think the legislature is going to change some of the laws here. And I think that they are ultimately going to wind up undermining their own power and authority, which I think is sad.
Let's move on.
Yeah.
Let's talk about your book and about the confessions of a recovering engineer, which sort of dovetails right into this. I've known about the book for a year. I've been waiting for it. I finally got my copy, although it is an advanced uncorrected proof. So I'm not allowed to resell it, which now I get to anyway. But I did enjoy it right from the very beginning. And the introduction itself, it's interesting. It actually made me very sad in some ways and angry. I was reading what you said and how you were defending your position. And I can see the process in this introduction of how you've gotten to where you are now from where you were when you first became a professional engineer. And I can just, you know, it's almost like it was building up. So tell us a little bit about what this means, this Confessions of a Recovering Engineer.
Yeah, if the licensing board is mad at me before, wait till the book comes out.
Exactly.
My mom read the introduction, and my mom has the book, and she's been reading a chapter every now and then and giving me feedback. And she read the first chapter, the introduction, and she's like, Chucky, this is not, like, I did not, this is not my boy. I said, well, yeah, this was, Mom. And, you know, for those of you that have seen the Conversation with an Engineer video on YouTube, which was released, it's crazy, almost 10 years ago now. It's had 350,000 different views. And it's these two digital bears talking to each other. One is an engineer and one is a homeowner has some, you know, interest or concern with the project. And I go through and give that dialogue the background that is actually in my head at the time. I created that video as this kind of compilation of many different conversations that I had in my time as an engineer. And so putting the background in was a little bit, it was adding depth to something that has really resonated with people. And I wanted to present myself as an engineer, as someone who had training, had good intentions, have, you know, well thought out ideas, has code books and backing and prestige and insider access and all the things that, you know, I think engineers give them a certain amount of credibility to go forward and do the things they do. And then I wanted to undermine that. I wanted to show why that ultimately is not our salvation and why we need a different approach. And so I'm glad that was you, like my mom said, this chapter was unsettling to them. And that makes me happy because I think that's where I want people to be when they get to the first chapter of the book.
It was visceral. I mean, every answer you gave, it sort of just showed what, I mean, if you know you and you know what you do now and you look back, and I don't know when that original, and it wasn't, it was a reconstruction of a conversation. It wasn't real, but you know, you reconstructed it. It's like, you must read it and look back on it and go, wow, was this really me? And yet, you know, at that time it was you.
Yeah.
And it's not who you are now.
Well, in my defense, you know, I can read that and say, this was me in my arrogant youth, right? you know, cause when you become an engineer, you not only get what is a technical degree. So I'm going to say this and no offense to those with liberal arts degrees, but technical degrees. I mean, I had 7 quarters of calc. I had, you know, a couple of years of physics. These are degrees that a small percentage of our population are able to get because they're very rigorous and very hard. So you get this degree that kind of sets you apart from others. Then you take a big test. Then you do 4 years of apprenticeship under an engineer, you know, tutelage. Then you take a really brutal test. I mean, I took the AICP planning certification test and I didn't study and I passed it on the first time. The PE exam, the professional engineer exam, I studied for 6 months, like 5 nights a week, and I barely passed the thing. It is a tough, tough test. So when you get a license, you've accomplished something that few people can. And I think, you know, as a 22-year-old who had reached this point in my career, or at that point I had the license, yeah, I was 25, 26. I had a lot of confidence in myself and my profession and in the things that I had been taught. It took a lot of unlearning and quite frankly, a lot of very patient people helping me along the way. And, you know, thankfully some humility kind of imposed on me for me to start to think differently about this stuff.
And you have. And so I think let's take a short break. And when we come back, let's unpack some of the stuff in the book. We're speaking with Chuck Marone from Strong Towns. We'll take a break. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist, as we said at the break, speaking with Chuck Marone. His new book, Confessions of a Recovering Engineer, is finally coming out. When is the actual publication date?
September 8th.
Yeah, so it's coming up really, really quick. I'm glad we're going to sort of wet the whistle of some people who might want to get a copy. So give me a synopsis of the book, and then we'll take apart some of the chapters.
Yeah. The idea is that at the end of World War II, we started to build transportation systems in this country across the entire continent. There had been different experiments with building auto-based transportation systems in different cities, but we started essentially a grand economic project on reshaping America. And as part of that, the engineering profession came up with certain standards, approaches. We adopted certain ways of doing things, and we standardized them across this continent as a way to do this transformation very quickly. Those ideas need to die. They need to go away. They served a certain function for a certain period of time. I'm not sure I would have done it that way, but we did. But the reality is that we're a very different country today and a very different aspect of society. And instead of creating a system that will replicate itself across a continent very, very quickly, we need a system that will mature our cities, get more use out of what we've already built, make our places more livable, more productive, better places to live, increase our overall prosperity. And the transportation approach we have today is not designed to do that. It's designed to do something else, which is build new things. And so my book is about reimagining that system and basically confessing the errors and mistakes that are embedded in the current system in the hopes that we can get beyond them and then offering what that new approach would look like.
Why do you think you're getting so much pushback?
Because there's, I mean, we're about to pass a $1 trillion infrastructure bill. There's a lot of money at stake in this system. There's a lot of people who are lined up, you know, from City Hall all the way up to the halls of Congress to basically do the next thing based on this money being allocated in the current flows that it's allocated in. And I would radically change and transform that. I would shift, you know, the first book I wrote was Strong Towns, a bottom-up revolution. And I would shift the power in our transportation system dramatically from the real top-down systems that deliver transportation today to real bottom-up systems that respond to people and their lived experiences.
So in Washington, you have a new transportation secretary who seems fairly savvy.
Love the guy.
Me too. We all love Secretary Pete.
Yep.
And he's all over transportation in a much different way from previous secretaries. You know, he believes in biking and walking. He believes in, I mean, he comes from a small town, actually. You know, it's not that big in Indiana. So what are the possibilities? I don't know how much money is in this package, in these packages, because it's really not one package, it's a whole series of things that you think will actually trickle back down to the states and then to the communities, which is where you believe this stuff should start.
Yeah, I've written extensively, and by extensively, I think I'm up to 15,000 words now in like you know, 10 different columns about how horrible the infrastructure package that's being debated is now. I do love Pete Buttigieg. I was in South Bend a number of times, sat in his office with him, love what he did there. Think it's a huge inspiration and a great example for cities around the country to follow. Right now, it feels a lot like the goal of a transportation package at the federal level is not good transportation policy, but it's good politics and optics. How do we get a bipartisan package that can show that we can actually do something together? And the answer to that question is to reduce it down to building more roads. That's like the one thing that our political system can agree on, is that if we just build more roads, more interchanges, more frontage roads, more highway miles, that things will get better. And we can at least agree on that. And I fundamentally disagree with that. I also, quite frankly, get frustrated. And I say this with kindness to the many people I know who do this work. I get frustrated with the bike walk advocates, the transit advocates, and others who are, like you say, trickle down to us, are willing to celebrate the tiny table scraps that they get while being overwhelmed with the worst kind of transportation funding possible, while also acknowledging that the system is falling apart. Even the aggressive plan that we are, you know, so-called aggressive plan that we're going to fund now, would only address 25% of the derelict, you know, the bridges that are in poor condition. It would only deal with 12% of the roadways that are in poor condition. And understand that that list is a list that grows every day, grows every year. It's not even going to put a dent in the accumulated liabilities we have. And so if the best we can muster is to slow the rate that things fall apart while giving table scraps to investments at the local level that would actually pay off and make people's lives better, I don't care if it is a mayor that I really like, and I don't care if it is a president that wants bipartisanship. I'm not a big fan of that approach.
Boy, I have to say that I see your point exactly. Taking all of this money, and it is a ton of money, and throwing it right back to a system that we know doesn't work. So I know that the president, the administration has climate change as a you know, number one problem. So why do we need all this high speed stuff? We're trying to get people to stop driving their cars.
Yeah, I think this is there's a different vision, and I feel like the bottom-up energy is at odds with the top-down energy when it comes to infrastructure. And it's why I find it really hard to engage at the federal level. I mean, Strong Towns is a localist organization, and we focus like almost exclusively on the bottom-up conversation and how we help people do things at the local level. Because if your vision for prosperity is shifting people from gas vehicles to electric vehicles, I don't think that that scales. And I also don't think that it actually solves the problems that you're after in terms of climate reduction. The way we start to deal with some of these things in a substantive way, in a way that will not just require huge expenditures of money to get people to do things differently, but actually accelerate change around a different vision for how society would order itself and how we as people living in society would want to live. It has to be, shifting from the crazy neighborhood situation we have now to neighborhoods that people want to live in. How do we start building corner stores again? How do we start an economic model where people can walk to and bike to where they work and where they live and where they get their daily things? I live in a neighborhood where I can go walk to get my haircut and walk to get, milk and walk to work. I am 1%. I mean, like the 1% of the population that has that capacity, 99% of Americans do not. If we could get that to 5%, 10%, 20%, it would be a revolution, not only in the way people live, but in climate reduction, the CO2 emission reduction in the US. And the thing is, it's a scalable model, and it will actually make the economy better, our cities better, our fiscal situation better.
So what about goods and services, things that need to be transported? Are there better ways to do that? Bringing the produce. I mean, of course, local produce would be the answer to that. Farms. That doesn't work in some climates. That doesn't work all over the country. But you do still have, and we seem to be a country that insists on having Amazon stop at the door every day. Right. So that would have to change.
In some ways, I mean, I do think that in the future, and I don't think it's going to be the distant future, I think that what we will see is that Walmart and Target and Costco all become localized versions of Amazon, which is really not a bad thing per se. I mean, it's basically the model that you would have had back in the railroad era, where everything came in on the railroad, it was unloaded at the rail yard. And then there were lots of people who would make small little trips around delivering things. That is kind of the model that we've been evolving to, and then accelerated a lot during the pandemic when people couldn't leave their homes and they'd start to order their groceries and order their things and they would be delivered to them. The whole big box model out on the edge with everybody driving to that and getting your stuff there, financially is not a viable model for local governments. And it's actually not a great model for those companies either. They would be better off as warehouses. And I actually think that that's where it ultimately will go. If that's the case, the logistics become really easy. Because, I mean, you can bring in everything a place like that needs overnight when there's no congestion and unload and load. And then you've got a bunch of local trips. And it actually becomes really easy to do.
We're going to take another short break, and when we come back, we'll talk with Chuck Marone about how to move forward on some of these ideas. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Jenks, and we're speaking with Chuck Marone from Strong Towns. So how do you start talking to planners to revolutionize this old way of thinking into something that is both sustainable and that people are going to want?
I'll go back to the first book, Strong Towns. I feel like the very first thing that planners specifically need to do, and I just think like local governments in general need to do, is to understand that we can't build any more infrastructure. The idea of adding new lanes, new streets, new sidewalk and curb, new pipe under the ground, there should be no new anything built anywhere. We already have, in some places, 20 times the amount of infrastructure that our tax base can sustain. And so what the focus has to shift to is, how do we make better use of all the infrastructure we've already built? And that should be the obsession of planners. It should be the obsession of engineers. And it should be the obsession of elected officials. And quite frankly, everybody who lives in a community whose house value, home value, property taxes, sales taxes, everything is wrapped up in sustaining this thing that financially is not viable. That should be our obsession.
Well, I have a little tiny story to tell you before we tell listeners. I mean, I could talk about this stuff all day. I definitely went into the wrong line of work when I became a bike dealer, but because I have just fallen in love with this whole transportation and planning and urban everything. But South Euclid, which is the little town I live in, you know, it's a ring suburb of Cleveland, received a grant from the, I think it's NOAACA, Northern Ohio Area Coordinating Agency, and along with some other things, to take one of our north-south streets and to give it a road diet and put two bike lanes in. And the first half of it is well underway and will be done, and the second half will be done next year. And it is a model, apparently, that they're looking at. So I finally think, after many, many, many years in this town, that since something's kind of happening, the question is, will people stop complaining and like it and, you know, use their bikes and get to where they want to go? I mean, South Euclid doesn't have much of a quote unquote downtown and not much of a really vibrant business district, but I'm not sure it couldn't get one by doing things like this.
Right. Let me rain on the parade slightly.
Okay, good.
and take this back, because I think that the challenge that we have is, you know, because I see this happening in a lot of places, like business as usual is going on. We're building new roads. We're building new subdivisions. We're adding new stuff. We're spending thousands and thousands, millions of dollars on studies and fees to add on to our system. And then the way that new things happen or policy shifts happen is that we come in with a grant money to try to get you to do something different. I hate this system. I hate it because I have been in those meetings where, you know, you're standing up and you're like, okay, can we do this bike lane over here? The study will be $2,000. They're doing it rock bottom price. We got to go out with paint and some cones and do a couple of things. It's going to cost like $10,000 total, but it'll make it a much better. And the city will go, well, can you do it for $8,000? And let's hem and haw. And can we cut this and cut this back? And then the engineer will come in and say, I got $200,000 study to look at this interchange and the traffic flow here. And they'll be like, well, yeah, of course we got to do that. And then bam, it's approved. And that is the reality at the local level. That what happens is the bureaucracies of government, the levers of government. And I don't say that derogatory, you know, like bureaucracy is a bad term, but the way we set up our government aligns along the large capital flows. So we're aligned to be very responsive to the transportation dollars that come in and the new development money that comes in and all this cash. If we realigned ourselves to actually focus on the needs of people in neighborhoods and what would benefit them, what we would find very quickly is that small bike project, that small walk project, that small project that makes it a little bit easier to get out of a car, that is a small investment. And it's an investment financially that pays a huge return. We would do hundreds of those projects in every city every year. Instead, we get one big top-down bike lane project delivered through the standard capital flow process that also has to fight with and compete with the traffic study for the interchange and the frontage road and every other like big auto-centric project. I hate it. I hate it. I get like, you know, the people who are into this are saying, this is how we're going to change the culture. This is how we're going to change the system. I am very skeptical of that. And I would like to see cities proactively reorient themselves, and state and federal government essentially support that and get out of their way and allow them to actually be good servants of the people in their community.
So interesting. I guess your job is kind of beating your head against the wall sometimes.
Well, yes and no. I mean, the thing is that the thing that's really heartening about the Strong Towns approach is that any city can do it right now today. You don't need money. You don't need wealth. You just need a different attitude, a different approach. And you can go out and start to build a biking and walking culture in your community. You can go out and respond to where people are biking and walking today and having struggles doing that, and say, how do we make that struggle a little bit easier? How do we get that next marginal person who would like to bike and walk, but is scared, or it's, you know, inconvenient, or it's dangerous? How do we get them off the sidelines and continue to grow the numbers of people who do this? And that can be done on a shoestring budget. It just requires will and focus. And so I'm beating my head against the wall in a sense that, like, the machine of the federal to state DOT, you know, process is maddening, but I wake up every day energized because I see cities that are opting to do something different and having massive success doing it.
Well, from our perspective, my husband's and mine, that's what we're looking for, a community that is doing that. And so far, we're not finding it, but I think we will eventually.
Well, I think Cleveland, I mean, Cleveland is one of these places where, you know, I think there's the impetus to do it. You almost need to go to a Memphis or a Detroit often to see places where the level of decline has gotten to the point where they're willing to look at other options at scale. And those places are really exciting because they're saying, like, this system didn't work for us. Let's do something new.
Right.
And they're being really effective at it.
Yeah. They're at the bottom going, we have no place else to go but up.
Yeah. So let's do this at the neighborhood level. Yeah. And it's really got a lot of energy to it.
All right. So the book's coming out this month, next month, September. Where can I get a copy? Oh, I know where. Go ahead. You tell them.
Well, the website we put together is confessions.engineer. That sounds like a weird URL, but it actually works. Confessions.engineer. And there we've got all the places you can get it. Seriously, if you can buy it from a local bookstore, do that, because that benefits us the most and it benefits your community the most. But you can get it anywhere. And we've got a whole list of places where you can go and get it on that site.
I do have one more thing to talk about. And that is, are you going back on the road this year?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Are you heading for the East? Where are you going?
Well, so we put out a call and said, does anybody want us to come with this book tour? And I think we got like 150 requests or something like that.
Be careful what you wish for.
Right, right. Which is great. We have made a commitment to, in the next year, try to reach get within driving distance of every place that asked. And that's basically like the country. So I know in September, I'm going to be in Texas and Louisiana and Oklahoma and Kansas. I know I'm doing something here in Minnesota and the Dakotas and Nebraska. There are plans for California. There's plans for Florida. There's plans for Michigan and kind of like the Midwest. There's plans for the Northeast, but those other ones are like, we've got September and October done. We're trying to plan November and December now, and then January, February, March. And that's kind of, I've got someone who works full-time planning that part of what we do. So,
well, it would be fun to have you in a situation where it's what, you know, you watching you work with a whole group of people instead of just talking to me.
Well, I will make it to your part of the world and we will do that. I mean, I know that I will be in Cleveland area at some point soon, and we will make that happen. That will be a ton of fun.
Well, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to talk with you. Chuck Marone, strongtowns.org, confessions.engineer. And good luck with the book. I know it's going to do really well, and I can't wait to talk to you again.
Thank you so much. It's always fun.
Yeah. I always enjoy my conversations with Chuck Marone.
His commentary about the bike walk advocacy community really resonated with me. If you would like a copy of his new book, Confessions of a Recovering Engineer, you can get one from your local bookseller or at confessions.engineer, but you have to wait till after September 8th. My thanks to Chuck and to Eldon Nelson for joining me on the show this week. Next week, we'll be unpacking a frame builder's survey with Benjamin Brewer from James Mason University in Virginia. We'll also catch up with John Sirico from Bloomberg City Lab about the infrastructure package that just was passed and what it might portend for biking and walking. My thanks to you, as always, for listening. Remember that you can join the variety of conversations that are going on daily on our Facebook page and follow us on Instagram at Outspoken Cyclist. You can also find a synopsis of each episode of the show on our website, OutspokenCyclist.com. There are links, photos, and you can even leave a comment. I hope you have a great week. Stay safe, stay well, and remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We welcome your thoughts and contributions on our Facebook page, or visit OutspokenCyclist.com to leave a comment on any episode. We will be back next week with new guests, topics, conversations, and news from the world of cycling. Subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast app and you'll never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.